Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we explore a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. We're here on an unusual night, though, and I hope that we have a live audience that will join us. Looks like we have a couple folks joining us, so that's good.
I hope our listeners can find us. They know that we have a regular time that the show occurs most of the time, but we do shift around when we need to once in a while, and this is an example of that. Last night was the first presidential debate in the U.S. presidential election. The first debate between the two parties' main candidates. There have been a whole bunch of debates leading up to this, obviously, and we thought it would be a good idea to take the night off and let people do their civic duty, watch the debate, and then come back to Fast Forward Radio and hear our interview with David Pierce talking about ending human suffering. Unfortunately, as we were recording that, preparing that show yesterday, we encountered some technical difficulties, and so that program is temporarily postponed. We'll see about working things out with David and getting him back on at some point down the road and having that conversation. But meanwhile, we got completely inspired by the presidential debate and decided that we would have a debate of our own, and we're going to be leaping into that here in just a few minutes. But before we do, Stephen, do you know what is significant about this date in history?
You know, I have no idea. I should never come on this show without looking, without doing a quick check, because this question has come up before.
Yeah, well, I'm always springing stuff on you, but this one I actually knew. I didn't read it anywhere, or this is a date that sticks with me. And the reason it sticks with me is because not for any huge historical importance, but this is Fast Forward Radio listener Ellen Welch's birthday today. And so if you're listening, I just want to say happy birthday, little sister. And she was born on the anniversary of something that occurred several years before she was born, quite a few years before she was born, I should say, which was in 1955, October 4th, excuse me, 1957, October 4th. Now, do you know? I gave you the year.
Help me out.
Sputnik.
Okay.
This is the day the world changed. The Russians launched Sputnik, the first man-made satellite launched into space, the beginning of the space race, really the beginning of the space age. 55 years ago today.
I feel a little stupid about that because, of course, I saw the Google doodle earlier today and took note of it, and it just completely left my memory for a second there. Yes, okay. It's
See, Google can only be part of your brain if you pay attention, Stephen. You gotta.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, it did make a huge difference, didn't it? I remember the movie about Homer Hickman as a child. What was the name of that? Rocket Boys?
Rocket Boys.
Like that?
Yeah, well, actually, the movie was called October Sky, which is an anagram of Rocket Boys, which was the name of the book.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So,
geek nerd.
The book and the movie tell the story of this. And he's a NASA guy, or was.
Yep.
And grew up in the middle of coal country, and where no one really, pretty much young man, that's what you did. You got through school and went to work in the coal mine, and that was pretty much what people aspired to. He aspired to something a little more, and that was his story. And Sputnik made a big impression on him, and I guess lots and lots of other people in the world as well. So.
Well, it launched a lot of careers. Really launched the U.S. space program. It changed a lot of lives. Really changed the second half of the 20th century. Really shaped it in a lot of ways. And of course, you can draw a straight line from Sputnik to Apollo. You can draw a straight line from Sputnik to the space shuttle, and I think you can draw a straight line from Sputnik to SpaceX and anything else that happens from here on. It's really the beginning.
I heard a very interesting story about Richard Feynman in his book, You Must Be Joking.
Mm-hmm.
He and a couple of other guys, they heard, well, you know, you can actually pick up the signal from Sputnik, you know, and so of course they run down and grab some equipment and they start, you know, monitoring it. And then they decide, well, you know, we can actually track it if we do this and this, and they do the math and everything. And before you know it, I mean, before the day was out, they had laid down the math that's necessary for our modern-day GPS.
Wow.
They figured out, okay, you know, if we got something in orbit and that's a fixed point, we're a fixed point in space and that's a point, we can try and, you know, they had it all worked out. And it was just a matter then of putting the infrastructure up there. After that, so it changed a lot of things.
There you go. I mean, that's a great example of just how influential it was, and you know how big a deal and how world changing of a deal the world transformed, if you will, to coin a phrase there. Well, tonight we're going to have an unusual format. We've never done this before. We're having actually not just one debate. We're having a series of debates. I've published the topics at the Speculist, and they're here on Fast Forward Radio as well. These are big-time, accelerating change, singularitarian propositions. And the way we've decided to do this is I will be arguing the pro-singularitarian stance, and in the role of Buzz Killington tonight will be my colleague Stephen. So, Stephen, I hope you're...
Yeah, thanks a lot, you know... always get the grunt work around here.
prepared to rain on everyone's parade repeatedly, I think, is your function here tonight. No, it's the idea is to examine these issues, to give them a hearing, and to see where they stand up and where they fall down. It's what a debate is all about, and we're going to do. I think we've got six of these lined up. We're going to try to keep each of them to about 8 minutes. So I'm actually going to use the old iPhone timer on these, so that we try to get through each of them. And I think without any further ado, I should note Jim Lehrer could not be with us this evening, so we're going to have to be our own. he is worn out.
It was a shame.
Tired, don't you think?
Yeah. It's a shame he wasn't with them last night either. But that was me.
I think people are being awfully hard on Jim Lehrer, I got to say.
Yeah,
you know,
perhaps so.
McNeil would have done no better, is all I have to say about that. Okay. that's my thing. Okay, so we're gonna jump into these, and our first topic is resolved. I for one welcome our robot overlords. So I'm going to go ahead and start the timer, and then I'm going to explain why that's the case. You know, a machine takeover of our planet is inevitable, and let me explain why. Anything that machines can do better than we do, we let them do that thing. You know, a machine can wash clothes better than a human being can, so we let a machine wash clothes. I use a machine to wash my clothes. A machine can do math calculations faster and better than I can, so I use a calculator rather than doing them in my head. A machine can get me from my house to the grocery store faster and better than I can get there myself, so I use one. And in fact, as I was thinking about this earlier, I thought, oh, well, but sometimes I ride my bike. And then it occurred to me, oh, that's right, it's a machine, and that's why I do it. You know, I can walk or run, but usually I use some piece of technology because the technology works better than what I'm able to do on my own. That's why we invented machines in the first place. Well, the bottom line is pretty soon, at the rate we're going, with the development of first very limited and ultimately very general purpose artificial intelligence, machines will be able to do just about any task we can do. We've just been talking about how they're going to be able to drive a car better than human. So not only will I use a machine to get from place to place, I'll use a machine to operate that machine. And pretty soon they'll be able to make better decisions than we can about just about anything. And that would include our use of resources, our personal safety, and even how we best ensure our individual freedom. Okay? When that happens, we're going to turn day-to-day, and I think even long-term decisions, management of our what you might want to call our social or collective affairs, that what we normally put under the rubric of government, over to machines, just as willingly as we started letting them wash our clothes. I think that to resist this inevitability is simply to spin our wheels and not prepare for a future that that is coming, and we need to be as prepared for as we can. That's my case. Stephen.
Well, I think it's interesting that you used the words individual freedom, because what you are describing, gentleman from Colorado, is a world that doesn't sound very free to me. Welcome the robot overlords. Well, should we welcome the job loss? Welcome the loss of meaning that would be if once we no longer have a useful purpose in this world? Welcome the great human, gloss of the human adventure and perhaps in space and elsewhere. Welcome becoming pets, or worse, pests. Some super intelligence. Welcome the loss of the great rite of passage in our Western society, which is learning to drive as young people. I don't know that I would welcome any of that. And it's very cool to have machines for some things, and we've kind of reached an equilibrium where we've decided, some things are worthy of machines. And well, I'll give you an example. There was a time that firearms were brought in to, I believe it was Japanese culture, am I correct? And they were rejected by samurai culture. We could choose to do that. And there is some likelihood, I think, of a pushback, particularly when we're talking about loss of meaning and not being able to contribute anything to the world. And I think that we might decide that, this far, no farther with machines, and have sort of a Butlerian jihad like they had in the Dune, where we just decide, okay, we'll have machines for most everything, but thou shalt not
make a machine in the likeness of man's mind. Yes,
that's right, the likeness of man's mind. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would say, Jane, you ignorant slut, I think. actually, you raise excellent points. My colleague from Louisiana raises excellent points here. I think we must understand that the term robot overlords is facetious, and that when I talk about outsourcing what we've always considered to be the decisions made by government, the model of government that I am thinking of is a very American model in which bureaucrats and even the highest elected officials are, yes, viewed as leaders, but also viewed as our employees, our servants. They are our public servants. They are here to ensure our freedoms and ensure our rights, not to literally lord over us and tell us what to do or who we can be. Those rights are guaranteed to us, that they are inherent, and that's where we begin. Now, could machines fail to live up to that? I mean, that's a real possibility, that the machines might screw up. We know that people screw up all the time. The machines may be tyrants, as you're describing, Stephen. That's why we need to accept the inevitability now, so we can make sure we put good machines in place. Because we are going to eventually outsource this to machines one way or another. It will be too much of a bother not to. And I think that it only makes sense that we concentrate our efforts on doing it correctly, recognizing that inevitability.
Well, the inevitability. Do I want a machine? There's some things I'm just not going to want to outsource. I like chewing my own food, for example. Don't give me the baby food that's been pre-chewed by a machine. If you give away enough, at some point you've basically given away your life, And I think that there's going to be some things that we're just going to reserve to ourselves, at least for the foreseeable future. And I think that designing good machines is a good idea. You don't have to accept inevitability of machine takeover to be on board with designing good machines.
Yeah.
Any way you want to define good.
Well, I think I would agree. I don't want machines chewing my food for me. Actually, I don't want them. I don't want them making decisions about my own personal self-determination. What I would trust them to do better than we do is to make fair decisions about how resources are to be allocated, or how we can avoid going to war with another country, or how we how we might structure the economy. Because you raised an excellent point earlier, which is that machines will take work away from us. So how's the economy going to work after that? Well, I think we're going to have to rely on their intelligence to address that problem as well. There's 30 seconds remaining, Stephen, so I'll give you the final word.
Well, the final word is that, we are going to continue to make machines, and we are going to continue to rely on machines for the things that we already rely on them for, and we're likely to outsource some things to machines going forward. I suspect driving I mentioned driving earlier, I suspect that most of our driving, not all, but most, will be done by machines within 10 to 15 years, 20 at the most.
That's tough.
Something we're just going to continue to do ourselves and do so happily.
All right, that's the final word, and we'll move on now to our next topic. that was pretty good. I liked that one. We'll see if we can maintain that high level of
do as well going forward.
Lofty debate for this next one. Okay, resolved. Everyone who can should go for cryonic suspension or brain plastination. And I'm going to go ahead and start the timer. And let me explain why I believe this is the case. Okay, let's look at cryonic suspension, which is the process of people preserving their remains after death in order to be revived later when technology makes it possible, or brain plastination, where just the brain is preserved and ultimately the information from it would be retrieved, enabling potentially the revival of that consciousness. Okay, so there's two ways of looking at these processes. Either it will work or it won't work. If it will work, then in my view, philosophically, the case for cryonic suspension is self-evident. And I might as well sit here and argue for the use of resuscitative paddles in emergency rooms. If cryonics will bring people back, then we're simply talking about extending human life, which I believe is a good, and it is a self-evident good, one that need not be argued in favor of amongst rational people. The argument is simply that it's a good thing to be alive. Unless you've decided you don't want to be alive anymore, it only makes sense to take prudent steps to ensure that you're going to go on living. It doesn't work comes in two flavors. If they can't bring you back at all, well, that's a shame. But as long as you believe that there's a non-zero chance that they can, you have no reason not to do it. So I would say that that flavor of they can't bring you back is not a persuasive argument. Or they can bring you back, but it will just be a copy. It won't actually be you. And, Stephen, this is our problem of consciousness that we bump into all the time. And would there be continuity? Would this actually be the same person who comes out on the other side of either cryonics or plastination? And my point is that even if you never, you yourself, never have the experience of waking up one fine future morning, a copy of you will. And that copy is someone that you would like very much if you were to meet that person. And that copy will have the subjective experience of being you and will actually think, hey, here I am, the real me. I'm not a copy after all. That copy will know everything you know and will remember all your experiences. Now, unless you believe that the world is no better off for your presence, you should come back, even as a copy. That's my argument.
Okay. No one. And not one single person, not one lab animal, has ever come back from such preservation. So we have no direct evidence that this works. All we have evidence of is the expense of this, neuropreservation, that's just the preservation of the head, is priced at $80,000. Full body preservation is priced at $200,000. So for that bargain basement price, you can attempt this and take the long shot at, and I would say extremely long shot, at having either coming back or having a copy of you present in the future. Or you could take that money and donate it to charity, where you know for sure that that money will be used to the good of whatever that charity that you choose does. I think that it might be an act of extreme hubris to go for the one chance in a million that this could work, rather than going for the sure shot of doing some real good with that money upon your death.
Well, hypothetically, I would answer that with, heaven forbid, one of us were to contract a terrible cancer or some other life-threatening disease, we might well go through a course of treatment that would cost $200,000 or even more. It's entirely possible that that amount of money would be spent on treating that illness. And yet, you would never sit down with someone in the hospital and say, you know, instead of saving your life with this $200,000, that money could go to charity. And then we'd know for sure, since this is only a coin toss on whether this cancer treatement is going to save you, why don't we give the money?
And family members never, loving family members never sit down with their beloved father and say, you know, Dad, I'd rather have the inheritance. You know, go ahead and die.
That's one of my arguments on my list. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that conversation never takes place, but rational people make that decision every day, Phil. That they say, you know what, the chance of me beating this cancer is, you know, the doctor has told me is, you know, 1 in 100, and I'm suffering, and you know what, I'm gonna take the hospice care and go home and be comfortable and leave something for my family to live on after I'm gone, give to charity or whatever. That decision is made. People do make that decision, and I think it is a rational one.
Well, and I will go back to my original point, which is that if you look at your own life and in the balance, you don't see preserving your life as being a good compared to what else might occur in the world. I didn't mean that in a facetious way that just someone wants to kill themselves, but you've actually done the rational analysis. I can't argue with someone who has said, the world is not that much better off for my presence, right? That this money should be sent here. I can't argue with somebody about that because we each have to value our own life. But I will say a couple of things about that. One is, as I think I mentioned last week, or might not have had a chance to get to it, John Smart and the Brain Preservation Foundation, that is one of their major concerns of making brain plastination a relatively inexpensive project, and they're hoping for it to come in at around $10,000. So we're not looking at that huge price tag that's going to necessarily drain everyone's inheritance. So that addresses that issue to some extent. The other thing is, going back to your it's a 1 in a million chance, I would submit to you that everyone who goes for cryopreservation, every single person who does it, increases the chance that someday someone will be revived, that we will actually create momentum around this process, and that by more people doing it, the likelihood that each of those individuals will eventually be brought back increases substantially. So another reason for moving ahead with cryonics is simply to increase the chance that all those other people will get brought back, not just yourself, but everyone else who's come before and all those who come after. It's a positive step for yourself and for everyone else who is living or in suspension currently.
I'm going to cross the fence for just a second and argue your side for just a second. So,
okay, Stephen. We have 44 seconds.
You know, we can do that from time to time. I would say also that if the more people that do it, the more likely that price actually comes down. And
there you go.
So, yeah, there you are. So, and,
all right, 30 seconds.
Every
you can,
time somebody
you can
dies, the library burns. It's not a good thing. Let's try to preserve those libraries.
20 seconds. You still want to disprove me? You can conclude with why I'm wrong.
Okay. Okay.
15 seconds.
Well, I would just say it's an expensive thing right now. Not a lot of chance of that it actually works. Think about what that money can do.
All right. And with that, the time has expired, and we'll move on to our next hour. How are we doing? Let's see. We've done two, and we're at 25 after the hour, and we got three to go. I think we're just about right. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah, we're doing okay.
Okay, good. All right, so our next one, our next topic is, by the way, that was some good give and take, and I felt that you raised some really good arguments there. That was a good discussion. And I'm sorry about the ignorant slut thing. I just it had to come out at some point.
I'm not ignorant at all. Anyway,
I was thoroughly expecting you the first two times that I would hear that, and when you didn't use it, I felt like it was my job. So okay, our next topic resolved. AI research must continue in spite of the risk that it may lead to the end of the world. Wow, that is just a ridiculous thing to say. Okay, so now let me tell you why that ridiculous thing to say is true. Timer going. Okay, this argument is very closely related to what I had to say about welcoming our robot overlords. Now, artificial intelligence research may well lead to the development of an unfriendly, powerful, artificial intelligent entity that does us great harm, or more likely, just wipes us out altogether. I do not deny that premise. In fact, that premise is inherent in the resolution that we're making here. There is a non-zero chance of that happening. AI research is inherently dangerous, existentially dangerous to humanity. So why not just ban it? Why not do what Stephen suggested just a few minutes ago? From the historical example of the Japanese, who put away firearms in favor of samurai swords, and say we're just not going to do this because we're not ready for the technology. Well, going back to my earlier arguments, I would say that the continued development towards artificial general intelligence is an inevitability. Anything machines can do better than we do, we let them do that thing. If we stop specific research into artificial general intelligence, we're still not going to stem that tide, at least not entirely. We're not going to eliminate it, because we're going to keep developing machines that approach human intelligence levels, even if only to perform certain tasks. And if some technology accidentally wakes up, we have far less say in whether it will be benign than if we try to create a benign artificial intelligence in the first place. So we're much better off knowing what we're getting into here. Besides, even if we ban such research, what guarantee is there that everybody is going to comply with the ban? We know that bans are not universally respected or adhered to, so someone less skilled or less interested in how benign the AI is might go ahead and develop an artificial general intelligence that does great harm. So either way, the only rational course is to continue AI research in an effort to build a friendly artificial intelligence.
All right.
Stephen.
Once upon a time, this world had many human species. There was the Neanderthals. There were the little hobbit guys that we call Homo
Florenses,
I think. Yeah, I think that's right. And there are many other species, Homo habilis. I'm forgetting a big one. Anyway, there were a bunch. There were and they kept being winnowed down until we just have one. That's the experience this particular planet has shown us when it comes to more than one sentient species. This is not something that we've not imagined. The arrival of AI. We've spent a lot of time thinking about this over the last couple of generations. We've got Battlestar Galactica. We've got Matrix. We've got Terminator. None of these are particularly encouraging, Phil, and pretty dark futures, every one of them. Battlestar Galactica, they lost their planet over it, had to go looking for another planet. Matrix, they lost the planet over it. Terminator, they lost the planet over it. I mean, it tends to be something that it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing. So, you know, when it comes to something as huge as whether or not we make it as a species, nothing is too great a step to take to keep it to keep that that kind of future from happening. So if it takes banning AI research, I say let's ban AI research. Back
to you. All right. Well, first off, Stephen, I want to remind you that as much as we love fiction, it is fiction. These are made up stories. And as our friends from H Plus the Digital Series pointed out a few weeks ago, if you don't have the shark show up, Jaws is not a terribly interesting movie. So naturally, in order to create drama around these kinds of conflicts in fiction, we are going to explore the dark or downside of where these technologies can take us. And I don't think we should, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think we should be aware of those possibilities. And once again, that possibility is inherent in the argument I'm making. The possibility that that it could be game over is a very real one. I think that the remedy you're suggesting is simply not workable. No step is too large to take. Well, I'm afraid this step is too large to take, because the only way to ensure this would be to somehow ensure total renunciation of computer technology and total renunciation of development of same. And I don't see how that could be enforced. I don't see anyone stepping up and saying, yes, this is so important that we're going to just, you know, really not just ban all AGI research, but essentially kind of like in Battlestar Galactica, where they didn't even really allow networked computers on the Galactica, right? It was just too dangerous. The Cylons might come in and take over. I don't think that with the genie this far out of the bottle, we're going to be able to stop. So once again, I talk in terms of an inevitability, which I absolutely see it as a evolutionary inevitability, that we will see artificial general intelligence. Therefore, as with the earlier argument, it's simply a question of whether we're going to have it happen under our auspices, have it happen as best we can under our control, and push it in the direction that we want to push it, or are we going to try to prevent it, have it pop up somewhere anyway, and then take our chances with that. I think those realistically are the parameters. And given those two choices, I've got to go with the one that gives us a very good chance of making it happen the right way. Because I just don't believe in the level of relinquishment that you're discussing, Stephen. I know that if Bill Joy were here, he would agree with you. But I'm going to have to take you and Bill Joy to task. I don't see us successfully stopping that forward motion at this point.
I'm going to go ahead and take the last word, if that's cool.
You got 1 minute.
You know, I suspect that artificial intelligence will continue to be developed. I believe that we will see sentient robots at some point. And artificial intelligence that maybe you wouldn't consider robotic because they don't move. You know, you got computers that are have artificial intelligence as well. So what do we do about that? Again, looking to the fictional stories because Phil, that's all we have at this point. What could happen? You could see systems of robo apartheid. You know, people who want to preserve jobs perhaps in certain areas. In the Matrix universe, robots and AIs were restricted to one country in the world. It was Iraq, by the way. And then, of course, in Blade Runner, the artificial intelligences were welcome off-world, but not at home. So, maybe we see something like that.
That's time.
Okay, that's time. I'll leave it at that.
All right. Very good. Very good. Good discussion. We're zipping right through this. We could have done a 2-hour show on this because there's a bunch more of these we could have done. But
we do part two to some other time.
Yes, we come next to perhaps the most controversial item on this list. Although I don't know how anything could be more controversial than my idea that just because it's going to be the end of the world doesn't mean we shouldn't move ahead with it. But this one is. Resolved, because animals are conscious beings, all killing of animals for any reason should be immediately discontinued. And I will tell you right now, before I go into my argument, that this is a very strong statement. That as I was putting my arguments together for this, I kept wanting for this to be a somewhat toned down version of this statement. However, clarity is better than niceness, and therefore I am going to argue exactly that. Because animals are conscious beings, all killing of animals for any reason should be immediately discontinued, and I will begin now. Okay, here's what we have. The Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness. This is a prominent international group of cognitive neuroscientists, neuropharmacologists, neurophysiologists, neuroanatomists, and how'd I get through all that neuro stuff and then I hang up on the word computational? Computational neuroscientists, they got together and declared the following. The absence of a neocortex does not appear to preclude an organism from experiencing affective states. Convergent evidence indicates that non-human animals have the neuroanatomical, neurochemical, and neurophysiological substrates of conscious states, along with the capacity to exhibit intentional behaviors. Consequently, the weight of evidence indicates that humans are not unique in possessing the neurological substrates that generate consciousness. Non-human animals, including all mammals and birds and many other creatures, including octopuses, also possess these neurological substrates. So my argument here is very simple. If birds and mammals and octopuses are conscious beings, we should refrain from mistreating or killing them for the same reason we refrain from mistreating or killing other human beings. We run in once again, Stephen, to the whole problem of consciousness, which I think we might eventually just rename the show The Problem of Consciousness, because we seem to bump
into
it
so
often.
Show.
And we know that subjectively, the only consciousness we're aware of is our own. However, there's a formula of reciprocity that we apply. I assume that other people are having subjective experiences along the same lines that I'm having, and because of that, we have a reciprocal approach to ethics summarized in the Golden Rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, that says we don't go around killing other people. But if other creatures are having the same kinds of subjective experience we're having, I don't see why that principle would not apply to them. Moreover, since we don't know for sure about fish and reptiles and other animals, we know that these higher animals, there's no reason to think they don't have consciousness, and we don't know for sure about the lower ones, we need to give them the benefit of the doubt, and we should refrain from mistreating or killing them on the chance that they, too, are conscious. It is a simple matter of extending the ethics that we theoretically all believe in to the next rational step.
All right. Well, my biggest problem with your resolution is the word immediately. How are we going to immediately discontinue killing all animals for any reason? And let me give you an interesting example that just came up today. My kids are in Boy Scouts. My two oldest are Boy Scouts. The two younger guys are Cub Scouts. They got a fellow a Boy Scout member who is about to make Eagle, and so his Eagle project is to trap pigs, and he's given some away to charities here locally, soup kitchen or whatever. But the real main thing about this is getting rid of a huge pest in this area. These wild pigs in Louisiana are an ecological disaster. Louisiana is not the only place that that's the case. Hawaii, I mean, they got a real problem there. These pigs are non-native to the area. They don't have predators. They just absolutely take over. You put a boy pig and a girl pig out in the wild, and they fall in love. And what do you know? In a couple of years, you've got 200 pigs. I'm not kidding. Every 6 months, a sow can give birth to 10 or more little piglets, and she's ready to go next 6 months later with 10 more, and those piglets are ready to give birth themselves in another 6 months. If anything in this world is close to a treble, it is a pig, and it's a constant thing that you have to, according to the biologist that talked to the Boy Scouts this evening, you have to kill 80% of their population every year just to keep their numbers level. And so you know, and we're not even talking meat here. We're talking just to keep them from being overrun by these things. So that's just an interesting thing that came up just this evening, and so I thought I'd bring that in. I would say that you know, once we have the ability to grow meat in vats, I think that it'll be awesome to have ethical meat. It could very well be more ecologically sound because it takes so much to grow a whole animal just to eat part of it for its meat. And it could be much more efficient to do it other ways. And so, yeah, I'm all for the development of ethical meat, but that's a little down the road yet. And so my problem is the immediate part. We can't immediately get rid of killing of animals for those reasons and many others. Lab animals, still useful. Maybe simulations, computer simulations of lab animals and really lab people, computer simulated lab people, will be robust enough to be of use someday. But it's not. We're not quite there yet. And so,
As I said, this is a very stringently phrased statement. But I think you get clarity out of that because I will share your discomfort with the immediate. And if you a couple of things about that, if you don't go the immediate route, you're in the Thomas Jefferson argument about slavery. Now, Thomas Jefferson is normally good company to be in, but one thing he is noted for is he believed slavery was a great moral harm to the world and a great travesty and a great crime against humanity, and yet continued to own slaves his entire life. So he is remembered for all the great things he did, and for that particular hypocrisy, which is what we commit if we say, well, what if they were people, right? If they were people who were being killed, we wouldn't say, well, we got to wait until we find some other way to do it, or blah blah blah. We would say, oh, we can't kill all these people. And if we are extending the same argument to animals as to people, then we simply have to stop it now. Now I'm going to switch sides real quick, Stephen. And I'm going to give you the devastating answer that you should have provided. Okay, this is how you can shut me up. Phil, what did you have for dinner?
Yes, what did you have for dinner, Phil? Did you have a chicken salad or did you have a hamburger? What did you eat?
I had some beef stew, as a matter of fact. So okay, I am in the unenviable Thomas Jefferson position right here, making this argument. I think that taking the guise off of the pure singularitarian, that realistically, Stephen, you make excellent points about how quickly and thoroughly this can be implemented. I think we do need to continue to take steps in this direction, and that we will continue, and that we'll actually see accelerating progress in this direction. But the notion that we can just stop immediately is ultimately, I guess I'm making the last statement here, ultimately unrealistic.
Well, let me make the last statement real quick. I have a friend, actually it's a couple, that they're Hare Krishnas. They're here locally. And Hare Krishna, I don't know how to pluralize that. I'm sorry. At any rate, that is their belief, and that includes strict vegetarianism. I can tell you that it is quite a commitment. It takes a lot to get the protein that you need without eggs, without dairy, and of course without meat.
Right.
They literally do not eat any animal products at all, and it takes a lot. You have to really work at it to get the protein you need, and I suspect they probably do without some protein that they could use, and so it's just hard, and expensive, I would say.
I would say we're past our time. Two great questions in the chat room. One about bugs. I won't get to it. As far as do we prevent other animals from eating other animals, I think that the answer to that has to be yes, because again, we stop people from killing other people to the extent that we're able to. So as odd as it seems, then we would have to stop lions from eating gazelles and feed them something else, lion chow or some such. Okay, we're gonna move on now. We're on our second last one. We got a lot, still got a lot to do here, Stephen. We're not going to make it. I'm going to limit this one to 6 minutes, okay?
Okay, all right.
Just so we can finish. Resolve, nobody should go to college anymore. And let me change the timer. And let me begin. Listen, the cost of a college education is outrageous. There are increasing numbers of highly trained, well-educated, unemployed people saddled with college debt. New alternatives for receiving education and being certified are coming on strong. And I would refer my opponent to a recent piece in the Boston Globe entitled "In the Future, Everything Will Be a Coffee Shop" for some background on that. Listen, higher education is a bubble. It's one that is going to soon burst, and nobody should go to college right now. They should use alternatives that currently exist. Now, if you're pursuing a career for which alternatives don't currently exist, I think the best advice is wait. You're going to be financially much better off if you delay a few years and wait out the inevitable bursting of the higher ed bubble. By the time you do return to school, you will not be, quote, going to college as we currently understand the term, but you will be getting the education and the certification you need without subjecting yourself to financial ruin, which is what we see a lot of young people doing today. So using the phrase go to college to mean go to college in the traditional sense that, Stephen, you did and that I did, I stand very strongly behind the statement, nobody should go to college anymore.
Well, Phil, although the author of that Boston Globe piece is beautiful in both mind and body, I just have to take issue with the old no one should ever go to college anymore. I mean, yes, college is changing. There's going to be upheaval, and it's going to be huge. And college is never going to be quite like it was when I was there again, and when you were there, Phil. I mean, it's going to change fast, and it's going to be exciting. I think that if I were 18 at this point, I would do things quite a bit different than I did when I went to school. To put it this way, I didn't log on to the internet until 2 years after I had graduated from college. Talked to a college kid about that. You know, they can't imagine college without the internet. And
right.
And quite frankly, it's only going to become more that way as people take classes online. Some of them are going to be approaching free. And, you know, my thought, find a college that accepts some of these online courses, that accepts as many as possible. Get as many of those cheaper online hours as you can as part of your education. And, you know, that make that part of how you of how you keep your costs down. And I would suggest, I would agree with you, I'll go this far in agreeing with you, Phil, that no one should go into the kind of huge debt that people seem to, you know, it's like no matter how much it costs, I don't even care. You know, you're telling me that this is, you know, this number of dollars, I don't even care. It's a college education. What else am I going to spend my money on? That attitude is going to change as alternatives present themselves. And so, no, do not go into such huge debt for college anymore. And there's a million ways to go about it. You can do the things I told you, you know, just mentioned, take as many of the hours online as possible, you know, get tutoring either online or off, and then you know, get the online hours as you're able to. And but there's another way. Work while you go to school. You know, there's no law that you have to finish college by 21 or 31 or 41 or whatever. You know, you just continue to be a productive member of society, and you finance your own college as you go, and a lot more opportunities are arising to allow you to get college in different ways. But no, yes, I should say
no. Yes, come on,
college.
Make up your mind.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah. So I go to college. But college, you know, going to college might mean just going to your computer, but go to college. So that's my answer.
You know, and obviously we are probably more in agreement on this than it sounds like. And I'm supporting a very strong statement, which is that no one should go to college anymore. And I'm being very very specific in what I mean by going to college. I'm talking about what I did and what you did. And more to the point, I guess I'm talking about what kids have been doing recently, which is mortgaging their entire future on an education that is simply not an investment that's paying off for them. It's becoming a huge financial burden. And I would suggest, in line with the arguments that Peter Thiel has made about the great need for reform of higher education and the possibility that people might just bypass that altogether and be more successful in life, that like with cryonics, where if we could get some momentum going in the direction of people doing cryonics, it's going to drive the price down and increase the likelihood that it will succeed. I think if college-age students were to simply say enough, that would force the issue much faster, although I believe the issue is going to be forced reasonably quickly anyway. I don't think that 10 years from now people will be looking at nearly the same outlook for where a college education, what your options are or what it will cost. But I think anyone who can wait, I would still advise wait. And with 20 seconds, Stephen, you get the last word.
Don't wait. Go. But just don't go the same way that we went. It's, you don't want to incur the same debt. And you know, it's a sad thing to see people my age and older, and my age is now about to be 43, still saddled with student debt from 20 years ago. That's crazy.
Yeah. There are people my age and older, and I just turned 50, as listeners know. Okay, that's time.
Yeah.
And now we finally get to the one that gave this show the name that I think got everyone's attention. And I'm going to give us just 5 minutes on this one, Stephen, because I really don't see how there's any arguing with my point here on this one. So the final point, resolve sex is going to be not just better, but way better in the future. Let me explain. Look, we're all going to be hotter. We're all going to be sexy, immortal billionaires with superpowers. Also, we're all going to be nicer. We're going to be better people. And I will refer everyone to The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker, which shows that people are becoming less violent, more cooperative, and nicer, better people over time. Okay, so if you start with the assumption that sex is a good thing, if you make the participants more attractive and better people, the experience can only be better. I would add to that that thanks to VR and robotics, sex will be available to anyone who wants it, even people who otherwise were too shy or otherwise socially unable to experience it. And that same technology will open up worlds of possibilities for everybody else. We'll have variable settings, variable costumes, variable partners, and variable, shall we say, approaches to what goes on in intimate settings. Even for the most traditional of couples who don't want to vary partners or approaches, it's going to be a whole new world. Everyone benefits. There can be no argument. Sex is going to be better in the future.
Well, variable divorce too, Phil, because there's going to be a lot of people, and that just have a problem with the variations that you were talking about, particularly if they're having some sort of affair with an AI or something that they would never dream of having, with actual people here in this world. That's something that that's going to be a problem for many, many people. Sex is pretty fine right now, Phil. I mean, pretty good right now. It's to make it any better, I don't know that I would be a productive member of society if it was much better than it is. And so I'm saying, hey, maybe there's some things we just kind of, we leave kind of as is because they're pretty awesome as they are. Maybe we should concentrate on improving the world in other ways. I don't know, feeding the world, make sure everybody has clean drinking water. Maybe those things should be a little more important than, whether we can have sex with a technological orgy of available people. So anyway, there's my take.
Well, I appreciate that we've made it this far into the show, and no straw men have appeared until this moment. And Stephen, you whipped them out with great alacrity, but straw men they are, because I'm certainly not suggesting that we would make this a priority over making clean water available, or that the big end game is virtual orgies. I'll go back to my original argument, the first argument, which I think drives the whole thing, is that in the future we'll be hotter and we'll be better people. I'm hoping that the better people portion of that argument drives a lot of what you're describing off the table, or makes it less of a problem than we think it's going to be. I think that some of those fears are legitimate and some of them are hugely overblown. In the same way that we know that we have a high divorce rate, we had a high divorce rate before the internet. We have a high divorce rate now. I don't know that it's gotten substantially higher because of the internet, although there is certainly a good deal more pornography available today than there was a couple of decades ago. Has that completely, you know, brought marriage down? It has not. I think that my argument is not that people would give up or should give up traditional relationships, or that traditional values are wrong, or that they will go away, or that they would even become weaker. On the contrary, I think, as I said in the summation there, I think that traditional couples will benefit tremendously from this as well, from the technological side of it, simply because they'll have more options too, even if they don't want to exercise that full range of options that society might begin to explore. They're going to have some choices that they didn't have before, all within the context of pursuing a very traditional relationship driven by very traditional values. And I think that in the same way that entertainment is better, in the same way that food is better, in the future, sex is going to be better. 30 seconds. Stephen, you get the last word.
Okay. I would say that sex has gotten better, particularly for older men recently with the advent of Viagra, Cialis.
Oh, there you go.
Other things like that. You know, so I think that's pretty awesome. I would say that that's, you know, but that doesn't change really what sex is. It just makes sex available to people that otherwise physically wouldn't be able to, or wouldn't be able to do it to the extent that they would like. So
that's time.
I don't. Okay, and make that time. Basically, I'm going to tip my hat to you on that one, Bill. I happen to agree.
Okay.
I'll just blow that. Say, you know, okay, whatever. I'm looking forward to. A bright future in many, many ways, and that's just another one.
Just one of the many ways that the
one of the many ways.
Well, Stephen, I want to say this has been just even more fun than I thought it was going to be. I really enjoyed it. I thought you did a fantastic job arguing the contrary to the arguments that I was giving. I think we should do this again somewhere down the road. I think this is a great exercise for us both. Before we go to the music, I just want to remind everyone that next week is our five-year anniversary show. PJ Manny and possibly another guest or two will be joining us to celebrate 5 years of Fast Forward Radio on Blog Talk Radio. Hope you'll all be able to be with us. Stephen, what is our music?
The music is Just Like You by Brian Sharp.
Just Like You by Brian Sharp.
I'm sorry. I played that a couple weeks ago. The music tonight is Living in Your Past by Billy.
Who?
Living in Your Past. Billy is the artist.
Billy singing Living in Your Past. All right, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. We'll be back on Wednesday evening at our regular time in our regular place next week. Hope you'll all be able to be with us. And until next time, live to see it.
Confusion's what I'm hoping for.